Gods, like an onrushing flood, the mountains ravaged. As the battles extended in time and scope, the two leading gods called on the others to join them. "My lord, to the battle which is becoming extensive, why don't you go?" they asked a god, whose name is missing in a damaged verse. The question was clearly also addressed to Ishtar, for she is mentioned by name. In the clash of weapons, in the feats of heroship, Ishtar, her arm, did not hold back. As the two gods saw her, they shouted encouragingly to her, "Advance hither without stopping. Put your foot down firmly on the earth. In the mountains we await thee." The weapon which is lordly brilliant, the goddess brought forth, a horn, to direct it, she made for it. As she used it against the enemy in a feat that to distant days shall be remembered, the skies were like red-hued wool in color. The explosive beam tore apart the enemy, made him with his hand clutch his heart. The continued tale on tablets 5 through 8 is too damaged to be properly read. The partial verses suggest that after the intensified attack with Ishtar's assistance, there arose a great cry and lamentation in the enemy land. Fear of Ninurta's brilliance encompassed the land, and its residents had to use substitutes instead of wheat and barley to grind and mill as flour. Under this onslaught, the enemy forces kept retreating south. It was then that the war assumed its ferocious and vicious character, when Ninurta led the Enlilite gods in an attack on the heartland of Nurgle's African domain and his temple city, Meslam. They scorched the earth and made the rivers run red with the blood of the innocent bystanders, the men, women, and children of the Abzu. The verses describing this aspect of the war are damaged on the tablets of the main text. Its details are, however, available from various other fragmented tablets that deal with the overwhelming of the land by Ninurta, a feat whereby he earned the title Vanquisher of Meslam. In these battles, the attackers resorted to chemical warfare. We read that Ninurta rained on the city poison-bearing missiles, which he catapulted into it. The poison, by itself, destroyed the city. Those who survived the attack on the city escaped to the surrounding mountains, but Ninurta, with the weapon that smites, threw fire upon the mountains. The godly weapon of the gods, whose tooth is bitter, smote down the people. Here, too, some kind of chemical warfare is indicated. The weapon which tears apart robbed the senses. The tooth skinned them off. Tearing apart, he stretched upon the land. The canals he filled with blood, in the enemy land for dogs like milk to lick. Overwhelmed by the merciless onslaught, Azag called on his followers to show no resistance. The arisen enemy to his wife and child called. Against the Lord Ninurta he raised not his arm. The weapons of Kerr with soil were covered, i.e. hidden away. Azag them did not raise. Ninurta took the lack of resistance as a sign of victory. A text reported by F. Hrozny, Mithin von dem Gotha Ninib, relates how after Ninurta killed the opponents occupying the land of the Harsag, Sinai, and went on like a bird to attack the gods who behind their walls retreated in Kerr, he defeated them in the mountains. He then burst out in a song of victory. "My fearsome brilliance like Anyu's is mighty. Against it who can rise? I am lord of the high mountains, of the mountains which to the horizon raise their peaks. In the mountains I am the master." But the claim of victory was premature. By his non-resistance tactics, Azag had escaped defeat. The capital city was indeed destroyed, but not so the leaders of the enemy. Soberly, the text Lugali observed, "The scorpion of Kerr-Ninurta did not annihilate. Instead, the enemy gods retreated into the Great Pyramid, where the wise craftsman, Enki, Thoth, raised up a protective wall, which the brilliance could not match, a shield through which the death rays could not penetrate." Our knowledge of this final and most dramatic phase of the Second Pyramid War is augmented by texts from the other side. Just as Ninurta's followers composed hymns to him, So did the followers of Nergal. Some of the latter, which have also been discovered by archaeologists, were put together in Gebete und Heimen and Nergal by J. Bollenrucker. Recalling the heroic feats of Nergal in this war, the texts relate how, as the other gods found themselves hemmed in within the Giza complex, Nergal, lofty dragon beloved of Ikur, at night stole out, and carrying awesome weapons and accompanied by his lieutenants, broke through the encirclement to reach the great pyramid, the Ikur. Reaching it at night, he entered through the locked doors, which by themselves can open. A roar of welcome greeted him as he entered. Divine Nergal, Lord who by night stole out, had come to the battle. He cracks his whip, his weapons clank. He who is welcome, his might is immense. Like a dream at the doorstep he appeared. Divine Nergal, the one who is welcome, fight the enemy of Ikur. Lay hold on the wild one from Nippur. But the high hopes of the besieged gods were soon dashed. We learn more of the last phases of this pyramid war from yet another text, first pieced together by George A. Barton, from fragments of an inscribed clay cylinder found in the ruins of Enlil's temple in Nippur. As Nergal joined the defenders of the Great Pyramid, the formidable house which is raised up like a heap, he strengthened its defenses through the various ray-emitting crystals, mineral stones positioned within the pyramid. The water stone, the apex stone, the Lord Nergal increased its strength, the door for protection he, to heaven its eye he raised, dug deep that which gives life. In the house he fed them food. With the pyramid's defenses thus enhanced, Ninurta resorted to another tactic. He called upon Utu, Shamash, to cut off the pyramid's water supply by tampering with the watery stream that ran near its foundations. The text here is too mutilated to enable a reading of the details, but the tactic apparently achieved its purpose. Huddled in their last stronghold, cut off from food and water, the besieged gods did their best to ward off their attackers. Until then, in spite of the ferocity of the battles, no major god had fallen a casualty to the fighting. But now one of the younger gods, Horus, we believe, trying to sneak out of the Great Pyramid disguised as a ram, was struck by Ninurta's brilliant weapon and lost the sight of his eyes. An olden god then cried out to Ninharsag, reputed for her medical wonders, to save the young god's life. At that time the killing brightness came, the house's platform withstood the Lord. Unto Ninharsag there was an outcry, the weapon, my offspring, with death is accursed. Other Sumerian texts call this young god offspring who did not know his father, an epithet befitting Horus, who was born after his father's death. In Egyptian lore, the legend of the ram reports the injuries to the eyes of Horus when a god blew fire at him. It was then, responding to the outcry, that Ninharsag decided to intervene to stop the fighting. The ninth tablet of the Lugali text begins with the statement of Ninharsag, her address to the Enlilite commander, her own son Ninurta, the son of Enlil, the legitimate heir whom the sister wife had brought forth. In telltale verses, she announced her decision to cross the battle lines and bring an end to the hostilities. To the house where cord measuring begins, where Aser his eyes to Anu raised, I shall go. The cord I will cut off for the sake of the warring gods. Her destination was the house where cord measuring begins, the Great Pyramid. Ninurta was at first astounded by her decision to enter alone the enemy land, but since her mind was made up, he provided her with clothes, which should make her unafraid of the radiation left by the beams. As she neared the pyramid, she addressed Enki. She shouts to him. She beseeches him. The exchanges are lost by the breaks in the tablet, but Enki agreed to surrender the pyramid to her. The house that is like a heap, that which I have as a pile raised up. Its mistress you may be. There was, however, a condition. the surrender was subject to a final resolution of the conflict until the destiny-determining time shall come. Promising to relay Enki's conditions, Ninhursag went to address Enlil. The events that followed are recorded in part of the Lugal'i epic and in other fragmentary texts, but they are most dramatically described in a text titled, I Sing the Song of the Mother of the Gods, surviving in great length because it was copied and recopied throughout the ancient Near East. The text was first reported by P. Dorm in his study, La Souveraine de Dieu. It is a poetic text in praise of Ninma, the Great Lady, and her role as Mami, Mother of the Gods, on both sides of the battle lines. Opening with a call upon the comrades in arms and the combatants to listen, the poem briefly describes the warfare and its participants, as well as its nearly global extent. On the one side, where the firstborn of Ninma, Ninurta, and Adad, soon joined by Sin, and later on by Inanna, Ishtar. On the opposing side are listed Nergal, the god referred to as Mighty, Lofty One, Ra, Marduk, and the god of the two great houses, the two great pyramids of Giza, who had tried to escape camouflaged in a ram's skin, Horus. Asserting that she was acting with the approval of Anu, Ninhursag took the surrender offer of Enki to Enlil. She met him in the presence of Adad, while Ninurta remained at the battlefield. Oh, hear my prayers, she begged the two gods, as she explained her ideas. Adad was at first adamant. Presenting himself there to the mother, Adad thus said, We are expecting victory. The enemy forces are beaten. The trembling of the land he could not withstand. If she wants to bring about a cessation of hostilities, Adad said, let her call discussions on the basis that the Enlilites are about to win. Get up and go. Talk to the enemy. Let him attend the discussions, so that the attack be withdrawn. Enlil, in less forceful language, supported the suggestion. Enlil opened his mouth. In the assembly of the gods, he said, Whereas on you at the mountain the gods assembled, warfare to discourage, peace to bring, and has dispatched the mother of the gods to entreat with me, let the mother of the gods be an emissary. Turning to his sister, he said in a conciliatory vein, Go, appease my brother. Raise unto him a hand for life. From his barred doorway, let him come out. Doing as suggested, Ninhursag, his brother, went to fetch, put her prayers before the god. She informed him that his safety and that of his sons was assured. By the stars, she gave a sign. As Enki hesitated, she said to him tenderly, Come, let me lead you out. And as she did, he gave her his hand. She conducted him and the other defenders of the Great Pyramid to the Harsag, her abode. Ninurta and his warriors watched the Inkites depart. And the great and impregnable structure stood unoccupied, silent. Nowadays the visitor to the Great Pyramid finds its passages and chambers bare and empty. Its complex inner construction apparently purposeless. Its niches and nooks meaningless. It has been so ever since the first men had entered the pyramid. But it was not so when Ninurta had entered it, circa 8,670 B.C., according to our calculations. Unto the radiant place, yielded by its defenders, Ninurta had entered, the Sumerian text relates. And what he had done after he had entered changed not only the Great Pyramid from within and without, but also the course of human affairs. When, for the first time ever, Ninurta went into the house which is like a mountain, he must have wondered what he would find inside. Conceived by Enki, Ptah, planned by Ra, Marduk, built by Geb, equipped by Thoth, defended by Nergal, what mysteries of space guidance, what secrets of impregnable defense did it hold? In the smooth and seemingly solid north face of the pyramid, a swivel stone swung open to reveal the entranceway, protected by the massive diagonal stone blocks, just as the text lauding Ninhursag had described. A straight descending passage led to the lower service chambers, where Ninurta could see a shaft dug by the defenders in search for subterranean water. But his interest focused on the upper passages and chambers. There, the magical stones were arrayed. Minerals and crystals, some earthly, some heavenly, some the likes of which he had never seen. From them there were emitted the beamed pulsations for the guidance of the astronauts, and the radiations for the defense of the structure. Escorted by the chief mineral master, Ninurta inspected the array of stones and instruments. As he stopped by each one of them, he determined its destiny, to be smashed up and destroyed, to be taken away for display, or to be installed as instruments elsewhere. We know of these destinies, and of the order in which Ninurta had stopped by the stones, from the text inscribed on tablets 10-13 of the epic poem Lugali. It is by following and correctly interpreting this text that the mystery of the purpose and function of many features of the pyramid's inner structure can be finally understood. Going up the ascending passage, Ninurta reached its junction with the imposing grand gallery and a horizontal passage. Ninurta followed the horizontal passage first, reaching a large chamber with a corbelled roof. Called the vulva in the Ninharsag poem, this chamber's axis lay exactly on the east-west center line of the pyramid. Its emission, an outpouring which is like a lion whom no one dares attack, came from a stone fitted in a niche that was hollowed out in the east wall, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 49. It was the Sham Destiny Stone. Emitting a red radiance which Ninurta saw in the darkness, it was the pulsating heart of the pyramid. But it was anathema to Ninurta, for during the battle, when he was aloft, this stone's strong power was used to grab to kill me with a tracking which kills to seize me. He ordered it pulled out, be taken apart, and to obliteration be destroyed. Returning to the junction of the passages, Ninurta looked around him in the grand gallery, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 45. As ingenious and complex as the whole pyramid was, this gallery was breathtaking, and a most unusual sight. Compared to the low and narrow passages, it rose high, some 28 feet, in 7 overlapping stages, its walls closing in ever more at each stage. The ceiling was also built in slanting sections, each one angled into the massive walls so as not to exert any pressure on the segment below it. Whereas in the narrow passages only a dim green light glowed, the gallery glittered in multicolored lights. Its vault is like a rainbow. The darkness ends there. The many-hued glows were emitted by 27 pairs of diverse crystal stones that were evenly spaced along the whole length of each side of the gallery, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 50A. These glowing stones were placed in cavities that were precisely cut into the ramps that ran the length of the gallery on both sides of its floor, firmly held in place by an elaborate niche in the wall, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 50B. Each crystal stone emitted a different radiance, giving the place its rainbow effect. For the moment Ninurta passed by them on his way up, his priority was the uppermost grand chamber and its pulsating stone. Atop the grand gallery, Ninurta reached a great step which led through a low passage to an antechamber of unique design, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 46. There, 3 portcullises, the bolt, the bar, and the lock of the Sumerian poem, elaborately fitted into grooves in the walls and floor, hermetically sealed off the uppermost great chamber. To foe it is not opened, only to them who live. For them it is opened. But now, by pulling some cords, the portcullises were raised, and Ninurta passed through. He was now in the pyramid's most restricted, sacred chamber, from which the guiding net, radar, was spread out to survey heaven and earth. The delicate mechanism was housed in a hollowed-out stone chest, placed precisely on the north-south axis of the pyramid. It responded to vibrations with bell-like resonance. The heart of the guidance unit was the Gug, direction-determining stone. Its emissions, amplified by 5 hollow compartments constructed above the chamber, were beamed out and up through 2 sloping channels leading to the north and south faces of the pyramid. Ninurta ordered this stone destroyed. Then, by the fate-determining Ninurta, on that day was the Gug stone from its hollow taken out and smashed. To make sure no one would ever attempt to restore the direction-determining functions of the pyramid, Ninurta also ordered the 3 portcullises removed. First to be tackled were the Su, vertical stone, and the Kashara, awesome, pure, which opens, stone. Then the hero stepped up to the Sag Kal stone, sturdy stone which is in front. He called out his full strength, shook it out of its grooves, cut the cords that were holding it, and to the ground set its course. Now came the turn of the mineral stones and crystals positioned atop the ramps in the grand gallery. As he walked down, Ninurta stopped by each one of them to declare its fate. Were it not for breaks in the clay tablets on which the text was written, we would have had the names of all 27 of them. As it is, only 22 names are legible, several of them Ninurta ordered to be crushed or pulverized. Others, which could be used in the new mission control center, were ordered given to Shamash, and the rest were carried off to Mesopotamia to be displayed in Ninurta's temple in Nippur, and elsewhere as constant evidence of the great victory of the Enlilites over the Enki gods. All this, Ninurta announced, he was doing not only for his sake, but for future generations too. Let the fear of thee, the great pyramid, be removed from my descendants. Let their peace be ordained. Finally, there was the apex stone of the pyramid, the Ul, high as the sky stone. Let the mother's offspring see it no more, he ordered, and as the stone was sent crashing down, let everyone distance himself, he shouted. The stones, which were anathema to Ninurta, were no more. The deed having been done, Ninurta's comrades urged him to leave the battleground and return home. An dim dim ma, like on you art thou made, they told him in praise. The radiant house where the cord measuring begins, the house in the land which thou hast come to know, rejoice in having entered it. Now return to thy home, where thy wife and son await thee. In the city which thou lovest, in the abode of Nippur, may thy heart be at rest. May thy heart become appeased. The second pyramid war was over, but its ferocity and feats, and Ninurta's final victory at the pyramids of Giza, were remembered long thereafter in epic and song, and in a remarkable drawing on a cylinder seal, showing Ninurta's divine bird within a victory wreath, soaring in triumph above the 2 great pyramids, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 51. And the great pyramid itself, bare and void, and without its apex stone, has been left standing as a mute witness to the defeat of its defenders. Chapter 9. Peace on Earth. How did the pyramid wars end? They ended as great wars have ended in historic times, with a peace conference, with the gathering of the combatants, as at the Congress of Vienna, which redrew the map of Europe after the Napoleonic Wars, or the Paris Peace Conference that ended World War I with the Treaty of Versailles. The first inkling that the warring Anunnaki had convened in a similar manner some 10,000 years ago comes from the text which George A. Barton found inscribed on a broken clay cylinder. It was an Akkadian version of a much earlier Sumerian text, and Barton concluded that the clay cylinder was deposited by the ruler Naram Sin, circa 2300 BC, when this Akkadian king repaired the platform of Enlil's temple in Nippur. Comparing the Mesopotamian text with texts inscribed at about the same time by Egyptian pharaohs, Barton noted that the Egyptian texts centered around the king and are interested in his fortunes as he enters among the gods. The Mesopotamian text, on the other hand, concerned itself with the community of the gods. Its subject was not the aspirations of the king, but the affairs of the gods themselves. In spite of damage to the text, especially at the beginning, it is clear that the leading gods gathered in the aftermath of a great and bitter war. We learn that they convened at Harsag, Ninhursag's mountain abode in the Sinai, and that she played the role of peacemaker. Yet she is not treated by the text's author as a really neutral personage. He repeatedly refers to her by the epithet Tsir, snake, which stamped her as an Egyptian, Incite, goddess, and conveyed a derogatory connotation. The text's opening verses, as we have already stated, briefly described the last phases of the war and the conditions within the besieged pyramid that led to the defenders' outcry, leading to Ninhursag's decision to intervene. We learn from the continuing ancient chronicle that Ninhursag first went with her idea of stopping the fighting and convening a peace conference to Enlil's camp. The Enlilites' first reaction to Ninhursag's bold initiative was to accuse her of giving aid and comfort to the demons. Ninhursag denied the accusation. "My house is pure," she answered. But a god whose identity is unclear challenged her sarcastically. "Is the house, which is loftier and brightest of all, the Great Pyramid, also pure?" "Of that I cannot speak," Ninhursag answered. "Its brilliance, Gibel, is soldiering." After the first accusations and explanations wore off, some of the bitterness, a symbolic ceremony of forgiveness, was performed. It involved two jars holding waters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, a ceremony of symbolic baptism making Ninhursag welcome again in Mesopotamia. Enlil touched her with his bright scepter, and the power of her was not overthrown. The objections of Adad to a peace conference, rather than unconditional surrender, were already reported by us in the previous chapter. But then Enlil agreed, saying to her, "Go, appease my brother." We have already read in another text how Ninhursag crossed the battle lines to arrange the ceasefire. Having brought out Enki and his sons, Ninhursag took them to her abode in the Harsag. The Enlilite gods were already there, waiting. Announcing that she was acting in behalf of the great lord Anu, Anu the Arbiter, Ninhursag performed a symbolic ceremony of her own. She lighted 7 fires, one each for the gathered gods. Enki and his 2 sons, Enlil and his 3 sons, Ninurta, Adad, and Sin. She uttered an incantation and she lit each fire. A fiery offering to Enlil of Nippur, to Ninurta, to Adad, to Enki, coming from the Abzu, to Nergal, coming from Meslam. By nightfall the place was ablaze, as sunlight was the great light set off by the goddess. Ninhursag then appealed to the wisdom of the gods, and extolled the virtues of peace. "Mighty are the fruits of the wise god. The great divine river to his vegetation shall come. Its overflowing will make the land like a garden of God. The abundance of plants and animals, of wheat and other grains, of vines and fruits, and the benefits of a triple sprouting mankind planting, building, and serving the gods, all to follow peace, were then outlined by her. After Ninhursag had finished her oracle of peace, Enlil was the first one to speak. "Removed is the affliction from the face of the earth," Enlil declared to Enki. "The great weapon is lifted up." He agreed to let Enki regain his abode in Sumer. "The Eden shall be a place for thy holy house, with enough land around to bear fruit for the temple, and to have seeded fields. On hearing this, Ninurta objected, "Let it not come," the prince of Enlil shouted. Again Ninharsag took the floor. She reminded Ninurta how he had toiled, day and night, with might, to enable cultivation and cattle herding in the land. How he raised the foundations, filled the earth, raised the dikes. Then the affliction of war destroyed it all in its entirety. "Lord of life, God of fruit," she appealed to him. "Let the good beer pour in double measure, make abundant the wool, agree to the peace terms." Overcome by her plea, Ninurta relented. "Oh, my mother, brilliant one, proceed. The flower I will not withhold in the kingdom. The garden will be restored. To end affliction, I too earnestly pray." Now the peace negotiations could proceed, and we pick up the tale of the unprecedented encounter between the two warring gods from the text, "I sing the song of the Mother of the Gods." First to address the assembled Anunnaki was Enki. Enki addressed to Enlil words of lauding, "One who is foremost among the brothers, Bull of Heaven, who the fate of mankind holds. In my lands, desolation is widespread. All the dwellings are filled with sorrow by your attacks." The first item on the agenda was thus the cessation of hostilities, peace on earth. And Enlil readily agreed, on condition that the territorial disputes be brought to an end, and the lands rightfully belonging to the Enlilites and the people of the line of Shem be vacated by the Inkites. Enki agreed to cede forever these territories. "I will grant thee the ruler's position in the gods' restricted zone, the radiant place, in thy hand I will entrust." In so ceding the restricted zone, the Sinai Peninsula with its spaceport, and the radiant place, the site of Mission Control Center, the future Jerusalem, Enki had a firm condition. In return for granting Enlil and his offspring eternal rights to those lands and vital sites, the sovereignty of Enki and his descendants over the Giza complex had to be recognized for all time. Enlil agreed, but not without a condition. The sons of Enki, who had brought about the war and used the Great Pyramid for combat purposes, should be barred from ruling over Giza, or over the whole of Lower Egypt, for that matter. Pondering the condition over, Enki agreed. He then and there announced his decision. "The Lord of Giza and Lower Egypt," he said, "will be a young son of his, espoused to one of the female deities born when Enki had made love to Ninharsag. For the formidable house which is raised like a heap, he appointed the prince, whose brilliant wife, from the cohabitation of Seir, Ninharsag, was brought forth. The strong prince who is like a full-grown ibex, him he appointed, and commanded him to guard the place of life. He then granted the young god the exalted title, Ningish-Zida, Lord of the Artifact of Life." Who was Ningish-Zida? Scholars find the information concerning him meager and confusing. He is mentioned in Mesopotamian texts in association with Enki, Dumuzi, and Ninharsag. In the Great God list, he is included among the gods of Africa, following Nergal and Ereshkigal. The Sumerians depicted him with Enki's emblem of the entwined serpents, and with the Egyptian Ankh sign, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 52A, B. Yet they viewed Ningish-Zida favorably. Ninurta befriended him and invited him to Sumer. Some texts suggest that his mother was Ereshkigal, Enlil's granddaughter. Our own conclusion is that he was indeed a son of Enki, conceived during Enki's and Ereshkigal's stormy voyage to the lower world. As such, he was acceptable to both sides as guardian of the secrets of the pyramids. A hymn which H. W. Sjoberg and E. Bergman believe was composed by the daughter of Sargon of Akkad in the 3rd millennium B.C., exalted the pyramid house of Ningish-Zida and confirmed its Egyptian location. Enduring place, light-hued mountain, which in an artful fashion was founded, its dark hidden chamber is an awe-inspiring place. In a field of supervision it lies, awesome, its ways no one can fathom. In the land of the shield, your pedestal is closely knit as a fine mesh net. At night, you face the heavens. Your ancient measurements are surpassing. Your interior knows the place where Utu rises. The measure of its width is far-reaching. Your prince is the prince whose pure hand is outstretched, whose luxuriant and abundant hair flows down on his back, the Lord Ningish-Zida. The concluding verses of the hymn twice restate the location of this unique structure, the land of the shield. It is a term equivalent to the Akkadian meaning of the Mesopotamian name for Egypt, the land Magan. The land of the shield. And another hymn, copied and translated by Sjoberg, called Ningish-Zida, the falcon among the gods, a designation commonly applied in Egyptian texts to Egyptian gods, and found in Sumerian texts only one other time applied to Ninurta, conqueror of the pyramids. What did the Egyptians call this son of Enki, Ptah? Their god of the cord who measures the earth was Thoth. He was the one who appointed to be guardian of the secrets of the Giza pyramids. It was Thoth, according to Manetho, who replaced Horus on the throne of Egypt. It happened circa 8670 BC, just at the time when the Second Pyramid War had ended. Having thus settled the disputes between them, the great Anunnaki turned to the affairs of mankind. This peace conference dealt not only with the cessation of hostilities and the drawing of binding territorial lines, it also laid the plans for the manner in which the lands would be settled by mankind. We read that Enki, before the feet of the adversary Enlil, laid the cities that were allotted him, Enlil in turn, before the feet of his adversary, Enki, the land Sumer, he laid out. We can envision the two brothers facing each other, Enki, as always, the more concerned of the two about mankind and its fate. Having dealt with the disputes among the Anunnaki themselves, he now turns to the future of mankind. In the aftermath of the deluge, it was given farming and domesticated animals. Now it was the chance to look and plan ahead, and he seized the opportunity. The ancient text may well describe a spontaneous act, Enki drawing on the ground before the feet of Enlil, a plan for the establishment of human settlement centers in his lands. Agreeing, Enlil responds by drawing before the feet of Enki the plan for the restoration of pre-diluvian cities of southern Mesopotamia, Sumer. If the olden pre-diluvian cities of Mesopotamia were to be restored, Enki had a condition. He and his sons were to be allowed to come freely to Mesopotamia, and he, Enki, was to be given back the site of Eridu, the hallowed place of his first earth station. Accepting the condition, Enlil said, "In my land, let your abode become everlasting. From the day that you shall come into my presence, the laden table shall exhale delicious smellies for thee." Enlil expressed the hope that in return for this hospitality, Enki would help bring prosperity also to Mesopotamia, pour abundance on the land, each year increase its fortunes. And with all these matters settled, Enki and his sons departed for their African domains. After Enki and his sons had departed, Enlil and his sons contemplated the future of their territories, both old and new. The first chronicle, the one reported by Barton, relates that in order to reaffirm the status of Ninurta as second to Enlil and superior over his brothers, Enlil put him in charge of the olden land. The territories of Adad in the northwest were extended by a thin finger, Lebanon, to include the landing place at Baalbek. The territory that was in contention, we can describe it as Greater Canaan, from the border of Egypt in the south to the border of Adad in the north, with modern Syria included, was put under the aegis of Nannar and his offspring. To that effect, a decree was established, sealed and celebrated with a meal offering shared by all the Enlilite gods. A more dramatic version of these final proceedings is found in the I Sing the Song of the Mother of the Gods text. We learn that at that crucial moment, the rivalry between Ninurta, the legal heir, being the son of Enlil by his half-sister, and Nannar, the firstborn of Enlil by his official spouse, Ninlil, had broken out in full force. Enlil, we are told, contemplated favorably the attributes of Nannar, a firstborn of beautiful countenance, perfect of limbs, wise without compare. Enlil him loved, because he gave him the two all-important grandchildren, the twins Utu-Shamash and Inanna-Ishtar. He called Nannar Su-En, multiplying lord, an endearing epithet from which there stemmed the Akkadian Semitic name for Nannar, Sin. But as much as Enlil had favored Nannar, the fact was that it was Ninurta who was the legal heir. He was Enlil's foremost warrior, and he led the Enlilites to victory. As Enlil wavered between Sin and Ninurta, Sin enlisted the help of his wife, Ningal, who appealed to Enlil as well as to his spouse Ninlil, the mother of Sin. To the place of decision he called Ningal, Su-En invited her to approach. A favorable decision she asked of the father. Enlil weighed her words before the mother she pleaded. "Remember the childhood," she said to Ninlil. The mother quickly embraced him. She said to Enlil, "Follow your heart's desire." Could one ever imagine in those far-reaching decisions that were to affect the fate of gods and men for millennia to come, that the female spouses had played such a decisive role? We learned of Ningal coming to the aid of her husband. We have Ninlil being enlisted in persuading the wavering Enlil. But then there entered the scene yet another great goddess, and by her words achieved an unintended decision. As Enlil was urged by Ninlil to follow your heart, rather than his mind, to prefer the firstborn over the legal heir, Ninurta opened his mouth and said, his words of opposition are lost by a damage to the verses, but as the tale is continued, we learn that Ninharsag threw in her weight behind her son Ninurta. She cried out and lamented to her brother, like a pregnant woman she was agitated, saying, "Inside the ekar I call to my brother who an infant made me carry, upon my brother I call." But Ninharsag's appeal was ill-worded. She meant to appeal as Enlil's sister in behalf of the child Ninurta she bore him. But her call sounded like an appeal to Enki. Enraged, Enlil shouted at her, "Who is this brother of yours that you call, this brother who an infant made you carry?" And he made a decision favoring the line of Sin. Ever since then, and to this very day, the land of the spaceport has been known as Sin's land, the Sinai Peninsula. As his final act, Enlil appointed Sin's son as the commander of the Mission Control Center. He called in Shamash, the grandchild of Ninlil. She took him by the hand. In Shulim she placed him. Jerusalem, Ur-Shulim, the city of Shulim, was given to Shamash to command. Its name, Shulim, meant the supreme place of the four regions, and the Sumerian emblem of the four regions, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 53A, applied to it, possibly the forerunner of the Jewish emblem called the Star of David, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 53B, replacing the pre-diluvian Nippur as the post-diluvian Mission Control Center. Jerusalem also acquired Nippur's formal title of being the navel of the earth, the central point in the divine grid that made the comings and goings between earth and Nibiru possible. Emulating the concentric pre-diluvian plan based on Nippur, the site selected for the navel of the earth, Mount Moriah was located on the middle line, the landing path, within the landing corridor, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 54. It was equidistant from the landing platform in Baalbek, BK, and the spaceport itself, SP. The two anchors of the landing corridor also had to be equidistant from Mission Control Center, JM. But here there was a need to make a change in the original plans, for the previous artificially constructed house, which is like a mountain, the Great Pyramid, was stripped of its crystals and equipment and was rendered useless by Ninurta. The solution was to erect, still precisely on the northwestern corridor line, but north of Giza, a new beacon city. The Egyptians called it the City of Anu. Its hieroglyphic symbol depicted it as a high-sloping tower, with an even taller superstructure, pointing skyward as an arrow, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 55. The Greeks, many millennia later, called the place Heliopolis, City of Helios, the sun god, the same name they applied to Baalbek. In both instances, it was a translation of earlier names relating the two places to Shamash, who is bright as the sun. Baalbek, in fact, was called in the Bible Beth Shemesh, House of Shamash, or Heliopolis in Greek. The shifting of the beacon site at the northwestern anchor of the landing corridor from Giza, GZ, to Heliopolis, HL, also required a shift in the southeastern anchor to keep the two anchors equidistant from Mount Moriah. A mount only slightly lower than Mount St. Catherine, but still precisely on the corridor line, was found and adapted to the task. It is called Mount Shumar. Sumerian geographical lists called the two adjoining mountains in Tilmun, Ka Harsag, the gateway peak, and Harsag Zala Zalag, peak which emits the brilliance. The construction, manning, and operation of the aerospace facilities in Tilmun and Canaan required new supply routes and protective outposts. The sea lane to Tilmun was improved by the establishment of a port city, Tilmun City, as distinguished from the land Tilmun. On the eastern shore of the Red Sea, probably where the port city of El Tor still exists, it also led, we believe, to the establishment of the world's oldest town, Jericho, which was dedicated to Sin, Yeriho in Hebrew, and his celestial symbol, the moon. The age of Jericho has been an enigma that has continuously baffled the scholars. They broadly divide man's advancement, which spread from the Near East, into the Mesolithic, Middle Stone Age, which saw the introduction of agriculture and animal domestication circa 11,000 BC, a Neolithic, New Stone Age, 3,600 years later, bringing with it villages and pottery, and then finally Sumer's urban civilization, again 3,600 years later. Yet here was Jericho, an urban site occupied and built by unknowns, sometime circa 8,500 BC, when man had not yet learned to lead even a village life. The puzzles posed by Jericho pertain not only to its age, but also to what the archaeologists have found there. Houses built on stone foundations, had doors equipped with wooden jambs, the walls were carefully plastered and painted red, pink, and other colors, sometimes even covered with murals. Neat hearths and basins were sunk in whitewashed plaster floors, floors that were often decorated with patterns. Below the floors, the dead were sometimes buried. Buried but not forgotten. At least 10 skulls were found which were filled with plaster to recreate the features of the deceased, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 56. The features they reveal were, by all opinions, more advanced and finer than those of the usual Mediterranean dwellers of the time. All this was protected by a massive wall that surrounded the town, millennia before Joshua. It was raised in the middle of a ditch, nearly 30 feet wide and 7 feet deep, dug out of the rock without the help of picks and hoes. It was an explosive development, a spectacular development whose causes, Mellart says, are still unknown to us. The enigma of prehistoric Jericho is compounded by the evidence of its round grain silos, one of which was found still partly standing. In a hot depression near the Dead Sea, 825 feet below sea level, in an inhospitable place unsuitable for grain cultivation, there was found evidence of ample supplies and continued storage of wheat and barley. Who could have built this advanced town that early? Who had come to live in such a place? And whom did it serve as a fortified store city? The solution to this enigma lies, in our opinion, in the chronology of the gods, not of men. It lies in the fact that the incredible first urban settlement in Jericho exactly matches the period which, according to Manetho, encompassed the reign of Thoth in Egypt. His accession followed the peace conference. Egyptian texts say of his accession that it was pronounced in the presence of the determiners of Anu following the night of the battle, and after he had helped defeat the storm wind, Adad, and the whirlwind, Ninurta, and then assisted in making the two combatants be at peace. The period the Egyptians associated with the reign of Thoth was a time of peace among the gods, when the Anunnaki first and foremost established settlements relating to the construction and protection of the new space facilities. The sea lane to Egypt and Tilmun, via the Red Sea, had to be augmented by a land route that could connect Mesopotamia with Mission Control Center and the spaceport. From time immemorial, this land route led up the Euphrates River to the major way station of Haran in the Balik River region. From there, the traveler had the choice of either to continue south down the Mediterranean coast, the road later called by the Romans via Maris, the seaway, or to proceed on the east side of the Jordan, along the equally famous King's Highway. The former was the shortest route to Egypt. The latter could lead to the Gulf of Eilat, the Red Sea, Arabia, and Africa, as well as into the Sinai Peninsula. It could also lead to the western side of the Jordan via several suitable crossing points. It was the route over which the African gold was brought. The most vital of these, the one that led directly to Mission Control Center in Jerusalem, was the crossing point at Jericho. It was there that the Israelites crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land. It was there, we suggest, that millennia earlier the Anunnaki established a town to guard the crossing point and to supply the travelers with provisions for the continued journey. Until man made Jericho his home, it was an outpost of the gods. Would the Anunnaki have built a settlement only on the west side of the Jordan, leaving the more vital eastern side, where the King's Highway ran, unprotected? It stands to reason that a settlement should have existed on the opposite, eastern side of the Jordan too. Though little known outside of archaeological circles, such a place has indeed been found. And what was discovered there is even more astounding than what has been uncovered at Jericho. The puzzling place with astounding remains was first unearthed in 1929 by an archaeological mission organized by the Vatican's Pontifical Biblical Institute. The archaeologists, led by Alexis Malon, were surprised by the high level of civilization found there. Even the oldest level of habitation was paved with bricks, and though the period of settlement stretched from the end of the Stone Age to the Bronze Age, the archaeologists were amazed to find that the same civilization revealed itself at all levels. The place is named after the mound where it was found, Tel Gasul. Its ancient name is not known. Together with several satellite settlements, it clearly controlled the vital crossover point and the road leading to it, a road still followed to this day to a crossing point nowadays called the Allenby Bridge, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 57. The strategic location of Tel Gasul had been noted by the archaeologists when they began to dig up its remains. From atop the mound, one has an interesting all-around view. The Jordan on the west as a dark line, to the northwest the hillock of ancient Jericho, and beyond it the mountains of Judea, including Bethel, and the Mount of Olives of Jerusalem. Bethlehem is obscured by Mount El-Muntar, but the heights of Tekoa and the environs of Hebron can be seen. To the north, the view was unobscured for some 30 miles. To the east, one could see Mount Moab and the four mounts of Mount Nebo. To the south, beyond the mirror of the Dead Sea, one could see the Salt Mountain, Mount Sodom. The principal remains uncovered at Tel Gasul cover a period when it was occupied by highly advanced settlers, from before 4000 BC to circa 2000 BC, when the place was abruptly abandoned. The artifacts and irrigation system of a much higher standard than had been prevailed in the area convinced the archaeologists that the settlers had come from Mesopotamia. Of the three hillocks that together formed the large mound, two appear to have been used as abodes and one as a work area. The latter was found to have been subdivided into rectangular-like segments, within which there were built circular pits, frequently in pairs. That they were not hearths for food preparation is suggested not only by their pairing and profusion, why would 6 or 8 of them be required in one compartment, but also by the fact that some of them were cylindrical and went quite deep into the ground. Combined with them were enigmatic bands of ashes, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 58, the remains of some combustible material, which were covered with fine sand and then with regular soil, only to form the foundation of yet another layer of such band of ashes. On the surface, the ground was strewn with pebbles, the remains of rocks broken up by some force that also blackened them. Among the artifacts found was a small circular object made of fired clay, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 59, shaped with precision for some unknown technical purpose. The mystery only deepened by the discoveries in the residential areas. There, the walls of the rectangular houses collapsed, as though hit by a sudden force just above ground level, as a result of which the upper parts of the walls collapsed neatly inward. Because of this neat collapse, it was possible to piece together some of the astounding murals that were painted and overpainted on these walls. In one instance, a cage-like mesh shone over the object, created on the wall a three-dimensional illusion. In one house, every wall appeared to have been painted with some scene. In another, a recessed divan was so built that it enabled the dweller, while reclining, to view a mural that covered the whole opposite wall. It depicted a row of people, the first two of whom were seated on thrones. Facing toward, or greeting another person, who had apparently stepped out of an object emitting rays. The archaeologists who had discovered these murals during the 1931-32 and 1932-33 excavations theorized that the rayed object might have been similar to a most unusual rayed star found painted in another building. It was an 8-pointed star within a large 8-pointed star, culminating in a burst of 8 rays, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 60. The precise design, employing a variety of geometric shapes, was artistically executed in black, red, white, gray, and combinations thereof. A chemical analysis of the paints used showed that they were not natural substances, but sophisticated compounds of 12 to 18 minerals. The mural's discoverers assumed that the 8-rayed star had some religious significance, pointing out that the 8-pointed star, standing for the planet Venus, was the celestial symbol of Ishtar. However, the fact is that no evidence of any religious worship whatsoever, no cult objects, statuettes of gods, etc., had been found at Tel Gasul. Yet another anomaly of the place. This, we suggest, indicates that it was inhabited not by worshippers, but by those who were the subject of worshipping, the gods of antiquity, the Anunnaki. In fact, we have come upon a similar design in Washington, D.C. It can be seen in the foyer of the headquarters of the National Geographic.